This is Wake Up Call.
Another kind of daytime radio program.
On the Sports Map Radio Network.
All right. Let's do this.
Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
Hey, good morning. Good Thursday to you. That means a throwback Thursday for us, but it also means that we get to contemplate what the Philadelphia 76ers-Boston Celtics series is going to look like now. All right, so last night there was only one game in the NBA, Boston and Philly. Tonight it's Golden State and Los Angeles as the Lakers and the Warriors will meet in Game 2, and then a bunch of games coming up this weekend. But nevertheless, last night there was only one game, and it was Game 2 between the Sixers and the Celtics. And there was some anticipation as Philadelphia announced that Joel Embiid would indeed be playing in Game 2. Surprising, because I was kind of under the thought that if you're Doc Rivers, I get it. You're playing the Celtics, and you can't just take a night off, right? You shouldn't take a night off. Celtics can beat you in five. You can win game one, and they can beat you in five. They're that strong, and they're that good. But unless Joel Embiid is close to 100%, I thought, well, this must mean he's at that point, because why would I risk Joel Embiid when I've already earned the split and have got home court advantage in this series? But I understand what the Sixers were doing here. They're trying to get their MVP back in any way, shape they can. If it helps them win game two, better be up 2-0 than 1-1 if you feel like the other team could win in Philadelphia and could take control of this series. But it does change what worked for Philadelphia in game one, because now you're trying to facilitate his scoring. And that doesn't allow for the spacing that James Harden was getting in game one, where he scored 45 points. But Joel Embiid being on the court is a better option for Philadelphia. But it wasn't last night, because the Celtics routed them in the third quarter. They already had a halftime lead, and they won by 34 points. But here's the kicker. They won by 34 points when Jason Tatum scored only 7. So it's one of those angry efforts that you get from a team that was embarrassed in their first game. And the Boston Celtics were embarrassed in their first game. They mishandled the ball. They turned it over. Costly turnovers late. Dumb fouls. There was a bunch of things in game one that were terrible. And so to respond in game two like they did, especially with Embiid on the court, has now evened up this series at 1. Now, Embiid had 15 points and didn't look 100%. He fell down like 3 times, but never checked the knee. He never like hobbled back to the bench or anything like that. And Doc Rivers did the smart thing when it was out of hand. He took his starters out and said, "That's enough. We're not playing. Get out." So he scored 15 points. The one thing that he did do early in this game, which I think helped the Celtics, was he was tremendous at defending the rim. He had 5 blocks. All of them came in the first half. Now, how does that affect Boston? Boston is an outstanding three-point shooting team. They're one of the best in the NBA at it, and they're the best team in the playoffs at it. Right up there with Golden State. They are that good. They have a tremendous amount of three-point shooters. So in the first game, they had 26 three-point attempts. Last night, they had 51. Because, again, Joel Embiid is great at protecting the rim. No need to try to get paint points. Just shoot from the outside, what you do very, very well. And they knocked down 20 of them en route to this route. So now this series is taking a very interesting turn, because as we talk about all the time, these are the things that coaches will use to adjust. Doc Rivers now has tape of a game one victory without Joel Embiid and how they got James Harden in tremendous scoring opportunities. And now they have tape on what didn't quite work in game two when Joel Embiid was back out on the floor. So Doc Rivers now has until Friday to sort of make the Philly adjustments to get this team back to where they were cohesive with Embiid and Harden and Tyrese Maxey and everybody else, and figuring out a way to maybe extend a little bit to help protect the perimeter a touch if Boston is going to launch it over 50 times in their game. So, impressive win for the Celtics. You could tell that they were pretty angry. They had lost their last 2 home playoff games. You got to go back to game 5 against the Atlanta Hawks and then game 1 of that series with Philadelphia. But nevertheless, angry Boston team, furious at themselves, didn't turn the ball over last night, didn't look sloppy, very efficient. Again, they had Jason Tatum with 7 points. That means Malcolm Brogdon got a bunch coming off the bench. He knocked down 6 threes. So again, it was a night for the Celtics to sort of reclaim that number two. Now we're pretty much the de facto number one seed in the Eastern Conference. And let's look like it, because we haven't looked like it where we let Atlanta just kind of hang around a little bit too long. And then we got embarrassed by the way we played and watched Philadelphia without their MVP, without the MVP, take game one. So, again, good win for Joe Mazzulla and the Celtics in a very disciplined game. And being able, as I said earlier, being able to overcome a fact that Jason Tatum was relatively ineffective. But not all is lost for Philadelphia. I think Rivers said it best at the end of the game last night when he said, look, these are fixable. You just watch it on tape. You fix it. He knows he has Embiid back. He knows that, again, Joel Embiid's knee did not bother him. He didn't look 100%, but that's not – nobody is. I mean, everybody's tired. But he didn't look bad either. He didn't look like he was out there hobbling and he was a problem. He had a problem coming out to defend. That was an issue. But, again – that's what some of the adjustments are going to do for you when you're Doc Rivers. All right, tonight the Lakers and the Warriors will play game two. Now, the big question that the media seems to be gravitating towards in this series is it a must-win for the Lakers? Yeah, they got game one. Yeah, they earned the split. Same scenario in Philadelphia, right, where, hey, listen, just be happy you got an early 1-1 split with the first two games on the road. The Lakers have already accomplished that. But like Boston, Golden State's dangerous, and Golden State doesn't win a lot of road games, but it doesn't mean they can't. They showed in the Sacramento series that they can. Is it a must-win for the Lakers? I don't necessarily think it is, but I'm like the mindset of Doc Rivers. Just try to go up 2-0 because you can't take games for granted in this series. Right? Golden State could win this thing in five. And they could blow you out, and in a blink of an eye, you could be out of this thing. So, is it a must-win? I don't like the term. If the Celtics lose, I mean, if the Lakers lose, do I think the Lakers are out of this series? No, that would be the definition of must-win, right? And it's not must-win in the sort of literal sense, meaning their backs are against the wall. But we put it in the context of, does it make your life harder if you lose, like really hard if you lose? And I can't say that about this series. I can't say that about a game one. Oh, of course Steve Kerr might do things differently in game two, right? There are some things that I'm sure Golden State wants to fix in how they lost their game. How did they get down so that they needed a 14-0 run in the fourth quarter to begin with? Those kind of things. And what do they do defensively against Anthony Davis? And can they get Anthony Davis in some foul trouble early? So, again, he's not a monster for 44 minutes of a 48-minute basketball game where he's putting in 32 points and 20 rebounds. So that to me is it's not a must win for the Lakers, but I think don't take anything for granted against a team that you don't really match up that well against, but you did take some advantages in game one. The Anthony Davis situation is really intriguing to me. It really is. Because again, you're talking about a guy that you don't want to have to play 40 plus minutes a night, but you have no other choice. You're not pacing anything. There's no load management here. You've got to make sure that you play him in a way that he's so effective because there's nobody that matches up against him. It's not Kevon Looney. No one can defend him. That might force a double team on Golden State. So there's a lot of interesting things about Anthony Davis's availability and how many minutes he plays. But if you can get him in some foul trouble early, get him off the court, it goes in Golden State's favor. We talked about this yesterday after watching game one, and this has been the MO of Golden State for years and years and years, right? Their big men kind of disappear in the postseason, from Andrew Bogut to JaVale McGee. Like, they just disappear because they like to go small and they love that Splash Brothers offense. But in this case, because they're dealing with such an incredible interior presence of Anthony Davis, they're going to have to, they can't just forget that they have big men on their roster. They're going to have to utilize them. And utilize them in ways so Anthony Davis doesn't hurt them. But it also limits them in a way that, you know, it doesn't allow them to go small, which is where they're most effective. So that's what I'm interested in tonight. We also have got some games on Friday, including Denver and Phoenix, and the situation Monty Williams is going to have to deal with now that Chris Paul is not going to be available for game three with that groin injury. And Denver now up 2-0, playing two different styles of play and winning both styles of play. Got into a real defensive battle in game two. Everyone said, look, Phoenix is going to have to up the defensive presence. They did, and yet Denver was still able to get a double-digit victory, a 10-point win.
Does Phoenix even have a chance?
I don't know, man. Looking on a bench now that you have to bring in players that haven't played, right? Yeah, you have to bring in guys that have to kind of facilitate and now pick up some scoring. Yeah, it's going to I'm having a hard time seeing it.
And if all the reports are true with Chris Paul being out 3, 4, and 5.
Right.
I don't see it happening.
I can't see Chris Paul again. The scoring goes through Devin Booker and Kevin Durant, but
right.
Chris Paul is the facilitator of that.
It's like, who's stepping up to play point guard?
Right, who's going to play point guard? And so you're going to be asking a number of different guys, especially guys that aren't seeing a lot of playing time, to come in and pitch in and score. Right, that's kind of the issue. He's got to make a decision on who he wants to take the ball, who he wants to run the offense with. But yeah, it's to have a guy like Chris Paul who, again, allows that offense to flow. This is going to be an interesting adjustment. Now, again, you can feed off a home crowd in a game three. You can feel a level of desperation, so you turn it up just a little bit. Those are factors that are in play here for Phoenix in game three. But it's a real big loss to not have that floor general out there. And like we talked about with Kevin Durant, there's going to be moments he's going to have to take over a quarter, a whole quarter. And I want to see him do that. All right, we'll continue. It's Wake Up Call on Sports Map Radio. Chris Medlin is going to join us this hour. The Miami Grand Prix is coming up this weekend, another United States race. We'll talk to him about that. Star of Drive to Survive on Netflix. We'll continue. It's Wake Up Call.
You're listening to Wake Up Call. Sports Map Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
Oh, yes, May the 4th. So this is our Throwback Thursday today. Happy Star Wars Day, everybody, if you celebrate that kind of thing. Oh, Star
Wars. Nerds everywhere rejoice.
They do it every year, don't they? Every single year. Happy Star Wars Day.
Hey, I got my Star Wars shirt on.
Quick question for you. And you're a Star Wars guy.
I am.
All right. I grew up with the movie. I saw it in 1977, and then I had the laser disc when I was a kid.
Yeah,
I watched the original a million times.
I was told I saw it in the theater, but I was one.
Yeah, you were one. So there you go. I saw it at a drive-in. That was the first time I saw Star Wars. It was a drive-in movie that came in later. I didn't go to like the opening, you know, or anything like that. And I didn't even know what it was. I was young. I didn't know what it was, but I definitely knew about Empire Strikes Back, and I definitely couldn't wait for Return of the Jedi.
Yep.
Those were the three. Like, I could not wait for those. I had all the toys. Every Christmas I would get Star Wars toys. I had them all as much as I could. And this is what my friends and I played all the time. And, you know, we had to wait 3 years for the movies. And, like, especially after Empire Strikes Back, when we knew that, like, Darth Vader was Luke's dad, we didn't know how that was going to work out. And we're like, couldn't wait. We're kids. Like, 3 years to a kid it might as well be forever. Like,
yeah.
Like, 3 years equals eternity.
I was an old man by the time that came out. Right? That's how I felt.
You tell me something's 3 years from now, I'm like, all right, 3 years, I'll be there in a blink of an eye. And so, like, time's going by so fast. As a kid, you're like, nah, it's crazy. So, question for you, because you have kids.
Yes.
And I don't. I have now adults. Is Star Wars a dead franchise?
No.
It's not?
No. And this is how I know, right? Like, even leaving this morning, my son opens up his bedroom window because, you know, he has school early, and he screams out. He goes, "Dad!" And I'm like, "What?" He goes, "May the Force be with you."
Okay.
And he is all into the Star Wars canon. He has watched all the different, you know, whether it's been Clone Wars to, you know, he's watched them all. And it's kind of spilled over to my other two boys as well. But my oldest, who's 15, definitely a Star Wars nerd.
All right. I just want to get this larger, though. Do they have, are all their friends talking about it? Are all their friends buzzing about it? I mean, it's one thing to say my kid likes it, so nationally all the kids like it.
That's a great question. I think there is a small pocket of it, you know, but I don't know if it's like in our day, it was cool to talk about. I don't know if it's cool to talk about.
The reason I ask is because it feels like, okay, this is the way I see it. I feel like it was like George Lucas always said, I made kids movies. Like these were kids movies. And he never denied that, but adults liked it because it was Star Wars. It was interesting. Science fiction was cool for the time, the 70s. That's why he threw Ewoks in there. He knew the marketing was great. He owned the merchandise rights. So why not make something cute and cuddly? Make yourself a couple billion dollars out of this thing. But it felt like the newer, when Disney took over, it feels like nothing's working. Like nothing's outside of Baby Yoda, nothing's catching. Solo was a bomb at the box office. Nobody really liked season 3 of The Mandalorian. All these other movies, no one's jumping up and down about. The three movies that they made were terrible. Nobody likes them. Nobody rewatches them. Like it feels like they've been destroyed. It's like there's no enthusiasm anymore for this product. Galaxy's Edge, the Star Wars Hotel in Disney World, they're giving rooms away. They can't fill it up. They can't get people to go there.
I think that is, but isn't that more of a price point?
No, they've lowered the price.
Have they lowered the price finally?
You can get a room there anytime. But the reason what they did it was they thought, oh, everybody loves Star Wars. We just bought this for $4 billion. And the adults were like, yeah, if you do it the way we want. So the adults are sort of killing it. But I don't know how many kids are buying the toys and buying the can't wait for the next thing that comes out.
See, like, I don't think toys, like toys for us, here's my honest opinion. Toys are kind of going away.
Well, it better not, because that's the main reason they purchased this franchise.
I'm saying toys in general. Not just Star Wars.
Like just
toys.
Merchandise.
I'm just saying toys across the board, I think, are slowly going away as the age of electronics comes around. Because my kids, yeah. I mean, they don't play with toys at all. Even my 6-year-old, I mean.
But then you're going back to your own personal reference.
No, I know.
But are you noticing that in the industry?
I see that with other, like with their friends, like going over to the house. No one really has toys anymore. Like like you and I growing up, we had toys.
Sure. But I also had an Atari 2600.
Right. But I think
and
now
I also had like electric football.
But I think now, like, you know, with video games or with iPads, I mean, it's kind of moved away from that. But there are still like Star Wars themed like games, not just, you know, Star Wars licensed games, but you know, things that are kind of reminiscent to Star Wars. And whether it's a level in Roblox that my son likes to play.
I like, for me personally, I don't care. Like, I'm not into it anymore. I don't watch. I'm not interested in any more movies. I'm not interested in any more of that stuff. But that's not for me. They're not going to direct it to me anyway. They're looking at like a generation that is coming up and saying, can we catch them? Like my kids, the original movies weren't their movies. The prequels really weren't their movies. The latest movies, that's their movies. If my son likes Star Wars, he would have liked it because of the movies that came out just recently. He was too young for the prequels, and this was his. So me, I'm like, hey, I grew up with it. I loved it. But it's oversaturation in a point where I go, I don't even enjoy it. Like, I liked Andor. I thought that was kind of cool. But I'm just looking at it from, is it dying because they keep sending stuff and nobody seems to be consuming it in the right way, in the way you'd want to if you had Marvel.
No, and I can see that.
You know what I mean?
Like Marvel, Marvel exploded. And I think Disney was kind of hoping that Marvel would take, or Star Wars would take over the same way Marvel did. Because you couldn't get enough of Marvel.
Marvel was crazy. It was
but
nuts,
I think with Star Wars, I think it's a mixture of the two that, you know, maybe it's oversaturation, but it is. I think it's a lot. It's adults, you know, saying, you know, it's not giving me that same feeling like when I first saw it as a kid. And so they're constantly disappointed, constantly critiquing it. Now, I will say, I mean, you know, I didn't mind Force Awakens. Because that basically was Star Wars.
Oh, I thought that was kind of fine. Yeah, it was basically like the first one. That was kind of fine. But, I thought the other ones were terrible.
The Last Jedi, what was the other one? The Skywalker or whatever, something like that. I've rewatched them because they're on TV. It's not that I went out and sought after it. Like, you know what? I'm going to sit down and watch this like I would a Harry Potter movie or a Marvel movie. But, you know, if it's on like TV, it's like, well, I got to fold some laundry. I'll put that on. And that's what it's become. But I still think there's a fandom for it because, you know, when they do release, like when they showed the Ahsoka trailer, I think it's if you get away from the main characters, you might develop more fans and less critique because now you're diving into something that hasn't really been dove into before.
Now, if I bought something for $4 billion, I'd be shoving it down America's throat
every chance
I could get.
And I will say, I mean, you know, Disney did an excellent job with Star Wars. I'm going to call it Star Wars Land. I know that's not the right edge name for it. Was it Galaxy's Edge or something like that?
Galaxy's Edge.
I mean, I always refer to it as Star Wars Land. I think they did that right because it does feel like you're in a different planet.
Yeah. The question becomes how many people are really excited about that part as the franchise if you lose interest in the franchise?
Yeah.
Yeah, that becomes – if you have a generation that doesn't care and doesn't really know what this is, like, yeah, I know this is like my dad's thing. You know, this is like my dad's place. Like, I guess that's the Millennium Falcon, teach their kids the right way. Yeah, I know. No doubt. No doubt. All right. So, again, happy Star Wars Day, May the 4th. Also, it is the anniversary of the death of Adam Yauch of MCA, of Beastie Boys, who passed away on this date. A number of years ago, I forget the actual year. I think it was 2012. When he passed away at the age of 47, I'm a big Beastie Boys fan, so
I am too.
I always go still, rest in peace, MCA.
And it's regrettably the one show, one concert I've been to that I did not enjoy.
Oh, I know, you told me that. I was so disappointed.
I was severely disappointed when I saw them. This was back in like 2006.
I've never saw them in concert, but I've loved them for a long time.
It was a lot of ad-libbing. It was a lot of politicalness, and it was just like, oh, God, no, just sing the songs, please. Yeah. That's why I'm here. I'm here for a big karaoke sesh.
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
And I'm not getting it right now.
Exactly. This weekend is the Kentucky Derby. Did you know it's also – we're doing like anniversaries because it's like Throwback Thursday. Did you know it's the fifth – it's not the 50th anniversary of the date, but it's just the 50th year of Secretariat winning the Triple Crown.
All right.
So it's 1973 was when he won the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness and the Belmont. So they're kind of doing this Secretariat thing where they're saying the 50th anniversary because is there – it's like – records are made to be broken, but his just are not going to be broken.
No, do yourself a favor. If you have never, if you have been living under a rock for the last 50 years and never done it, watch the Belmont.
The Belmont is crazy.
It's one of the greatest clips in sports. It's most amazing. I mean, I've watched it a couple times and I still don't understand it. They're all the same size horse.
Real quick, 100. When they did the 100 greatest athletes, ESPN did. Secretariat was in the top 10, I think.
I think so, yeah.
And I kind of was like, what? And I remember my dad telling me, no, he deserves to be there. That horse was incredible. But I didn't know. Like, I was like, I heard of Secretariat, but then you see the video and you're like, oh, yeah, okay, now I get it.
It's nothing a little music can't help. Rockin' and rollin'. Down to the beach, I'm strolling.
This is Wake Up Call. On the Sports Map Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, May 4th. It's May the 4th be with you. It's Star Wars on a Throwback Thursday. This is a video clip of bad lip reading. With Yoda talking to Luke from Empire Strikes Back. Very cool. It's kind of funny.
It's really funny.
Yeah, this is one my kids showed me. I was like, oh, that's awesome. Really funny. So we're doing a lot of Star Wars songs today on this date because, again, May the 4th, so Star Wars fans rejoice. So game two tonight. Must win? That's a little harsh, don't you think? Or do you think it is?
I don't think it's a must win for either team.
Let's start. Can we come up with another term?
There's got to be one in between, right?
I want a term that says, like, there's must win. When I think of must win, I understand why people do
elimination.
It. I understand why people are like, yeah, but it's must win in this context. I get it. But can we use another phrase? Or is it just too simple to go, must win, but it's not like their backs are against the wall, right? We do it in football during the regular season. Mm-hmm. We're like, is this a must win? Nah, because they got a home game and they can, you know, all right. You know, when they're vying for playoff position and stuff. But in this case, we're just talking about game two in which the Lakers are just can leave San Francisco with a split. And yet I think it's too much emphasis on thinking the Lakers need this game. I don't think the Lakers need this game. I think they can go to Los Angeles and they can win at home. I think this could be a 7-game series. Now, again, Golden State could win this in 5, too, because they're that explosive. But I don't think the Lakers should be under pressure to be up 2-0 in a series because they're that much of an underdog that they better get it while they can. Now, I don't know. Anthony Davis really, as I was saying earlier, really throws everything for a loop. I mean, it really does add a dimension to this series that gets really, really, really intriguing. Like we saw last night with Joel Embiid returning. I'm really curious what game 5 is going to look like between these two teams. To get your MVP back, to have Jason Tatum score 7 points, and you still lose by 34? Like, Doc Rivers has got some tape to dissect, does he not?
It was you know pathetic. What I mean?
Let's take a look at this. And again, sometimes the ball just doesn't go your way. It doesn't fall. You got good looks, but they didn't drop. All those things. But I think there's some real adjustments that Doc Rivers is going to have to figure out. How do I get James Harden to be able to get 25 to 30 points? How do I get Joel Embiid to get up to his season average? How do I create so that there is there are opportunities that were missing in game 2 that were there in game 1? How do I do it with Joel Embiid on the floor? So those are the things. As we talked about earlier, Phoenix is going to play Denver in game 3 in Arizona on Friday. And the Chris Paul is out, and they're down 0-2. And they lost both games in Denver, and they lost both games in kind of different ways and different styles. They talked about having to go more up-tempo in game 2, but that's not what they did. It was a slowed-down defensive struggle. They played really good defense. They're either statistically the worst or second worst defensive team left in the playoffs. But yet they played as good as you could play against a Denver team and Nikola Jokic in game 2. But they lost Chris Paul, and that's a big problem. So what does Monty Williams do? Well, there's a conversation that TJ Warren, Terrence Ross, who've basically seen zero action since they were acquired this season, being able to come off and do something. Now, TJ Warren is the guy they picked up in the trade for Durant as part of the package. And then they signed Ross, who had played for Orlando, pretty much shortly after. And Warren's played like only 16 games with the Suns, and he's averaging about 4 points. Ross has seen some action, but he's averaging about 9. So these are the guys Monty Williams are going to be asked to go out there and put up some points and score some points in the situation without Chris Paul. We talked about the Phoenix Suns not having a lot of depth because of the assets that they gave away, but you do have players and you now have to go in. And when they talk depth, they talk about quality depth, but you do have players, and these are two guys that are going to have to pick it up for Phoenix. And they're going to have to figure out that the scoring still is going to go through Devin Booker, Kevin Durant, DeAndre Ayton. They're going to have to chip in as well if those things aren't working. I have a hard time seeing Phoenix winning this series because they're going to need to win out of the next 5 games. They're going to need to win 4 of them, meaning they're going to have to take over the series. And they're going to have to do so without Chris Paul, depending on how optimistic they are. I don't think it's optimistic at all. But that's a big, big haul. That's a big, big haul for them to have to do that. Can they do it? Yeah, of course they can. They have Kevin Durant. Yeah, they have Devin Booker. These guys can take over games. They can take over moments. And you never know when the bad night will come for Denver. But it's going to be very difficult. But, it's so funny. We always kind of pick on cliches in sports because they're cliches and everybody says the same thing. And every time you get in a series like this where you're down 0-2, and the coach says, we're going to have to take it one game at a time. It's like, yeah, well, that's the oldest cliche in sports. But it doesn't mean it's not true. It is true. You have to do it. You cannot look at the magnitude of what you're up against. You cannot look at how far you're going to have to look down the road to go, God, are we able to win 4 of these things out of the next 5 games? You are going to have to do that. With 3 of those at home, you are going to have to do that if you're going to win this series. And you have to take it one game at a time because you have to see what you're getting from guys. Like if you are relying on some of the veterans that you acquired, TJ Warren, Terrence Ross, those guys, if you're going to ask them to produce more when they're out there, then you want to see what that looks like. What does it look like? What do we get from Durant in the fourth quarter of a game that's tight? What can we do? You know, are shots going to fall? Are we going to take as many threes as we did before? That's not really our game, but we'll see. Those kind of questions. But it's the only way you can go about it. If you're Denver, and we're going to talk to George Karl this morning. If you're Denver, play the way you've been playing. You scored 120 points, 20 plus points in game one. You won out on a defensive struggle by allowing the game to kind of come to you in the fourth quarter, where you took advantage of some missed shots and then just extended the lead slowly. A game that was back and forth, back and forth. Phoenix actually had a lead, actually had a comfortable lead. You came back and tied the game. Then you had the lead. Then you extended that lead. Let those moments come to you. And if you have a Jamal Murray off night, that's okay, because Jokic can put in a triple-double anytime. So this is game three of this series is going to say a lot about how Phoenix is going to make adjustments without Chris Paul. That's a must win. I mean, are you kidding me? That's definitely a must win. Not facing elimination, but it might as well be if you lose game three and you're down 0-3. You're not beating Denver four straight. You're just not. You're not going up to altitude without Chris Paul, and you're not going to, unless you get him back in some way.
Yep. Might as well just pack it in at that point and just.
If you're down 0-3, you're not going
to call it a season.
So. But again, last night, impressive with the Celtics. That was an impressive win.
It really was. I mean, you know, especially being down at the first game. That first game was shocking to us.
I was amazed how sloppy that was. Yeah. That was just disgusting.
And then yesterday, it felt like, you know, they got all the pieces together. And I don't know if Embiid kind of him playing hurt the Sixers.
Yeah, I was saying this earlier. I think it allowed Boston to go, all right, cool, he's protecting the rim. We're not going there. We'll just shoot. They 51 three-point attempts. I mean, this is a fantastic three-point shooting team. They're bound to make 20 if you shoot it 50 times, and they did. They did. So you're going to have to defend the perimeter better, and you have to, leave it. And he had five blocks, which was like, okay, we're not doing that. But he fell down three times. He kind of stumbled on defense. He had one flop, but the others were just falling. He definitely didn't look 100%, but he didn't look like he was playing hurt so badly he was killing his team. But
no, he looks like he's probably injured. You know, he's probably in pain. But he's doing what every athlete should do, which is, you know, sometimes you got to play through the pain.
Yeah, you got to do that. Yeah. I mean,
and don't show
it. It's physical.
You never
want to
show it.
Marcus Smart was talking about this after the game last night. He said, listen, I've got a busted lip. It's very, very physical. But again,
it comes after an 82 game season.
Exactly. No doubt. It goes back to what I was saying before about, these injuries where when you have a player that's injured, right? Now, Jimmy Butler, I don't think was being nursed. I think Jimmy Butler could not play game two for Miami. I think it was swollen enough that he just couldn't play. But the question was, when we didn't know about the severity of the injury, was, all right, does Miami just sit Jimmy Butler anyway and just get a 1-1 and get out of there? Doc Rivers had the same question, but it goes back to what we were saying about the Lakers too, which is, and they're not dealing with that injury, but they're dealing with the idea of, don't take games for granted, right? Like Doc Rivers didn't want to take a game two and say, well, we won game one without him, but what's the likelihood that Mazzulla is going to do the same exact thing that allows Harden to have 45? I want to put Joel Embiid in there, even if he's not 100%, to change it up enough that they are not going by a game one tape, and maybe we catch him off guard and get game two as well. But let's not take game two so much for granted that we're so happy with the 1-1, because you don't know, this team could beat us in Philly twice and we could find ourselves in a hole. All right, Chris Bedlin's going to join us next.
Wake Up Call with Tony D and Ron Culver continues now on the Sports Map Radio Network. Here's Tony D and Ron Culver.
All right, Chris Medlin joining us on a Progressive guest line. Progressive drivers who switch and save with Progressive save nearly $700 on average. The Formula One Series is in the United States this weekend. It's the Miami Grand Prix. It's one of three races in the country that has seen a resurgence or seen a surge of interest in the sport. A lot of it thanks to Drive to Survive, Liberty Media that owns Formula One based in Denver. They also own the Atlanta Braves, trying to put more emphasis on the United States audience. So this is one of three. Austin, Texas, and Las Vegas are the other two. But the Miami Grand Prix will be this weekend, and Chris Medlin joins us. He's also in the Drive to Survive series and covers Formula One and motorsports around the world. How are you, Chris?
I'm good, thanks, guys. How are you guys doing?
I'm great. Thank you so much for joining us. All right, the Miami Grand Prix, last year it was the hottest ticket to have. It was one of the premier events. Everybody wanted to be a part of it. It was very new and exciting. Is it still carrying over into year two of the event?
It seems to be. I mean, I don't think the place is sold out completely yet, but they've increased capacity, and we've got a heads up from Formula One today, actually, that they're expecting over 250,000 people over the weekend. So 90,000 a day, which is pretty good going, really, isn't it? It's like selling out a massive NFL stadium 3 days in a row. So, yeah, the interest definitely seems to be there. I've just been driving around downtown, actually, here in Miami, and passing lots of people walking around in Formula One merchandise and T-shirts and things. So, yeah, there's a real buzz about the place, and it's going to be an exciting weekend.
As you go around the world with this sport, what has been the thought of America's new interest in this and the fact that three races will be on the calendar in 2023 in this country alone?
It's been largely really positive. I think everyone's recognized that, one, it was so tough for F1 to kind of get a foothold in America for ages that we couldn't even get one race that was doing well. And then Austin really did that kind of on its own. That was all before Netflix and Drive to Survive sort of helped the boom. But off the back of that, then that's led to a blueprint that other races can follow and then try and do something a bit different. So it's been really cool to get the additional races in. I think everyone recognizes the size of the country here, that the states can definitely host multiple races. You think of the number of races we have in Europe, you know, 7, 8, 9 races over the summer, over a similar kind of spread of landmass. It's a no-brainer to have more races here. Just every now and then, there's little changes made to kind of help the races in the US. I mean, this weekend we're going to have an extra driver presentation that means there's 10 more minutes before the race starts where they'll kind of show the drivers off to all the fans at the track. But last week in Azerbaijan, that kind of 10-minute protocol was already in place. It had to be written into the rules, but it wasn't used to present the drivers because it had all come together too last minute. So the drivers stood around for 10 minutes kind of doing nothing, going, well, what's the point in this? And it's all just to facilitate some of the bigger races over here the way they're going to do things. So every now and then it creates a little inconvenience, but there are small prices to pay for what's been a really exciting growth over here.
American drivers in Formula One, there have been a number of them. Alexander Rossi was the last one, but now Logan Sargeant is behind the wheel of a car. In a new way that this sport is leaning, trying to lean more into the United States and attracting United States viewers, is it important to have an American driver, or can Americans go, well, we don't need that. We'd like the drivers, even if they're not from this country.
Yeah, I don't think it's actually that important to have an American driver. I think it's great to have one. I mean, it's awesome that sort of maybe some casual fans or even some hardcore fans will have an American to get behind if they want to. But I think, you know, you guys know it better than I do, that Americans want to back winners. You know,
yeah.
your sports team, your baseball team, your football team, whoever it is. So Logan drives for Williams, so a team that's nearer the back of the grid, so he's never going to have a chance of winning at the moment. But he's in an early phase of his career where I think it's helped with, like, Drive to Survive. Fans understand, okay, in that car, we can't expect him to win. You know, a great result is to get a point or something like that. So the expectations are now much more realistic, and that's helping anyone. But as we've seen, again, from Netflix, that people get behind, you know, their favourite driver because they relate to them, whatever their nationality. So I don't think it's imperative, but in Logan, it's a great guy to have in, like, in the sport now, because he's young, he's quick, he's got a lot of potential, and he's starting off at the right sort of team to kind of cut his teeth and gain his experience. So I think we'll see him around in F1 for a few years, and he could move up the grid and eventually be that guy that is winning races and will get all of America behind him.
All right, let's get to the circuit. Last year it was, again, the inaugural race. It was a bit bumpy. Have they been able to work that out? And what do the drivers think of the speeds of the Miami Grand Prix?
Yeah, they've done a resurfacing of the circuit here in Miami around the Hard Rock Stadium to try and improve that with all the bumps. I didn't think it was that bad in the sense of, any time the drivers are complaining, it's normally a good thing. It means they don't have it easy. But parts of the track were kind of getting so broken up that it made it almost impossible to get the power down. And drivers were slipping around all over the place. And it just kind of makes a bit of a mockery. You make a small mistake and you end up losing a load of positions or something. So They've addressed that for this year. We'll see how that plays out when they first go out on track tomorrow. But most of the drivers like most of the track. The first sector, they're really fans of. The middle sector is cool as well. It's just a little section under one of the underpasses or one of the flyovers. So it's just very slow speed chicane that it kind of had to be there. There's no other way of designing the circuit layout for that part of the track. And that's the bit that a few of them are like, oh, if we can get rid of that, it would be a lot better. But there's not really many circuits. You know, we've got 23 races around the world. There's not many where every single corner, every driver loves. There's always parts of it that they're not delighted with. But here, largely big fans of it. And the first sector especially is a really cool part of track.
I'm talking to Chris Medlin. The Miami Grand Prix will be this weekend. So let's get to this season. So Red Bull is running away with it with the four races in the books and their two drivers each winning twice. On a two-part question here, one, is that a foregone conclusion that Red Bull is going to win this as a team? And what about the driver's race between their two drivers? Does Sergio Perez really have a chance of winning a championship over the reigning Max Verstappen?
So I'd say in the answer to the first part, yes, I think it's pretty much a foregone conclusion just because they're getting so many points in the bag right now. 1-2s, maximum points. And that car's not going to get much slower during the year. So I'd be amazed if the advantage that Red Bull are able to build up as a team right now can be overhauled. But in terms of drivers, so far, you'd have to say yes, Sergio has shown that he could do it. Realistically, up to now in his career, he's kind of excelled in street circuits, and this should be another track that he goes well at. But as we get into the summer and there's a lot more of the traditional European permanent tracks, that's a bit where you'd expect Verstappen to kind of excel, and he's still the heavy favourite. But you kind of only can judge Perez on what he's done up to this season, and it's kind of 2-2 in the main races. And they're races that he and Verstappen have pushed each other in. He's been in a clean race. He's not just lucked into Verstappen retiring or something. So he's done a better job than he has up to now. So that's been encouraging to see. I think what's also great about it is it means no one driver is running away with the championship. They're taking points off each other. It's not the massive gaps that you sometimes get as a result, because Fernando Alonso in third has been able to finish in the top four in every race. So each race he's only dropping a few points. And it means if any car can kind of get close to Red Bull later in the year, then the gaps might not be insurmountable to have another driver come into the mix for the title fight. So it's good from that point of view to stop, say, Verstappen just running away with it if he'd won all four races so far. So there's a good bit of intrigue there.
If you're somebody that's new to this sport, if you're in this country, for example, and you're somewhat new and you just got involved and Drive to Survive piqued your interest and you like motorsports, but you're really getting into this and you caught it in the 2021 season and you watched one of the greatest Formula One battles for a championship you've ever seen. How do you, that someone who's seen these year in and year out, the good, the runaways, the close battles, how do you tell somebody, hey, sometimes you get a year where a guy wins 17 races, and that's just the way it is?
Yeah, sometimes it seems tricky. One of the things I always try and say to people is also, when you get an epic season like 2021, that's made all the more special because of seasons like this, the ones that you know, but they're not always epic seasons. They're not always brilliant battles. You wish they were, but then if it was every year, you kind of get used to it, and it would dilute how special the special ones are. So that's one of the things. I mean, it's tough to say to people. It's kind of like, yeah, this is the short-term pain for the long-term gain. But also, you still get great races. You still get exciting races. You get drama. You never know when that's going to happen. You sometimes get total blowouts, but then, say, one driver's winning by half a minute and their engine fails with two laps to go, and it has happened plenty of times in the past. Yeah, you kind of end up watching just in case that happens. So, it's still sports, right? It's unpredictable. It's more predictable than many because of the machinery involved, but there's still humans that are building these cars, and they're incredible machines, and they're so complex that things can go wrong. And you kind of want to be watching just in case there's the shock result, the surprise winner, or even sometimes some external factors, weather, rain, track surface, can really mix things up and turn into a crazy race as well. So in the context of one driver dominating, you still do get some brilliant races.
Chris Medlin, again, thanks for joining us, and enjoy the race this weekend again, and one of three in the United States on the 2023 calendar. Always appreciate it when you come on, my friend. Thank you so much.
That's all right. Thanks very much for having me. Looking forward to it, and looking forward to being back later in the year as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it. Chris Medlin, again, joining us, covers Formula One around the world, part of the Netflix documentary Drive to Survive. People have caught that over the summer. It's a very interesting development that occurred. It was one of those situations where it was Tiger King and a bunch of other things that people were watching while we were all trapped in COVID. And this was one of them, this series that was put out before COVID. It just things people were watching, and then the surge of interest and the surge of popularity. Plus, when you when you put it together with an American company that owns the sport and the wanting to build up the interest in the United States, that's what you're getting this weekend down in South Florida with one of the races on the 2023 calendar.